Hi, this is the next podcast on trying to explain the Mass to Protestants. Now, we've been through stuff up to the point where we start the readings. The Mass, generally speaking, the Mass is divided into two components. The first component is called the Liturgy of the Word, and the second component is called the Liturgy of the Eucharist. Now, you can think of this as the two different origins of Christian worship. You have, on the one hand, the synagogue, and on the other hand, the temple worship. So, if you were to picture the modern-day Mass as a combination of synagogue worship and temple worship, that kind of gives you a picture of what we're talking about here. So the first half of the Mass is the Liturgy of the Word, and the main components of the Liturgy of the Word are the readings of Scripture, the homily, and prayers. So, at this point, we're up to the readings from Scripture. Now, a lot of people believe that the Catholic Church has some sort of problem with the Bible, that, you know, we don't like the Bible, we don't read the Bible, and all that. And as much as I hate to admit it, there's some validity to that charge. My mother was raised Catholic, and she was told by her priest that she shouldn't read the Bible because it would just confuse her. And apparently that was never magisterial teaching. That was never what the Church officially said. You know, if you look back at the documents of the Church, what the Church officially taught is ignorance of Scripture is ignorance of Christ. You need to know the Bible. You know, we read the Bible to people every Sunday at Mass, for heaven's sakes. There's three readings every week. There's lots of Scripture in the Mass. But the sad fact is, in some sort of misguided effort to keep people from becoming Bible-thumping Baptists or something, they told people not to read the Bible. And the Church is getting over that, and now there's much more emphasis on Scripture study and people learning about the Bible. Now, in the Mass, we have typically three readings. There's actually a lot of Scripture in the Mass. It's not just the readings. Most of the prayers are Scripture or taken from Scripture or allude to Scripture. Most of the elements of the Eucharistic rites are straight out of Scripture. So if you were to go sit down and listen to the Mass from start to finish and figure out how many words were spoken and how many of those words were a direct quotation of Scripture, it would be a really high percentage. I haven't done the calculation, I'm sorry. But it would be a lot. There's a lot of Scripture in there. Now, when it comes to the readings, generally speaking, there's an Old Testament reading, an Epistle reading, and a Gospel reading. Not always that way, but generally speaking. There's also a psalm. Now, the psalm is usually chanted in Gregorian chant. So, you sort of have four readings. Now, the first thing, of course, that will come to mind to a Protestant is, what books are they reading? Because this whole question of the deuterocanonical books, or what the Protestants call the apocryphal books. Now, this is an enormously complicated subject, and I'm not going to be able to cover it in the depth that it deserves, but I'll give a shot at trying to break it down into the basics here. Now, Protestants will say that Catholics added the apocryphal books to justify their screwball doctrines. And Catholics will say that Protestants took out books because they didn't like them. That's barnyard rhetoric. That's not what really happened. What really happened was the canon of Scripture was not definitively set until after the Reformation. Now, that seems rather strange, because, especially to Protestants, it seems ridiculously strange, because their whole faith revolves around this book that they carry with them to the church every week, and the idea of there being a church without having a fixed Bible just seems very, very strange. Here's something even stranger. To this day, the Lutheran Church does not have a fixed canon of Scripture. The Lutherans have a great big fat book of confessions, and none of them say which books are Scripture. A Lutheran can accept the book of Sirach or reject 3 John and Revelation and be fine. You can be a Lutheran minister and not accept the canonicity of the book of Revelation, and nobody will bat an eyelash. Now, there is a sense of sort of a core of books. These books are most certainly Scripture, the Gospels, for example. And then there are other books about which there was some debate in the early church. For example, 3 John, Revelation. People weren't entirely certain what to do with those books. In the Old Testament, there were books like that as well. People had a hard time with Ezekiel. People had a hard time with Esther because it doesn't mention God. So there is today in the Lutheran Church no fixed canon. And, you know, Lutherans get along just fine. They have church and they believe, you know, they have Sunday school and they do great. So the idea that you absolutely have to have a firm, fixed canon of Scripture in order to have a church just isn't true. And the church existed for a very long time without a fixed canon. Now, I say without a fixed canon, it's not as if they were all wandering around in the dark. Oh my goodness, is the Da Vinci Code in the Bible? You know, it wasn't like that. They had a good sense of these are the right books, but there were some books about which scholars would debate. Now, in Luther's day, for example, Luther doubted the deuterocanonical books, Sirach, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, those books, right? So did Cardinal Cajetan, who was on the, you know, against Luther. He was on the Roman Catholic side. So the issue wasn't fixed. In the Council of Florence, before Luther's time, the books that are in today's Catholic Bible were said to be inspired, but they weren't said to be canonical until the Council of Trent. Now, but I still haven't got to this issue of why do we have two different sets of books? Why do the Protestants have 39 books in the Old Testament, the Catholics have 46? Well, it's because the early church used a translation of the Old Testament called the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and it differs somewhat from the Masoretic text, which is the Hebrew text that we get from the Masoretes. This is like a 10th century Hebrew version of the Old Testament. So we have this gap here between the Septuagint, which was translated several centuries before Christ from Hebrew into Greek, and the Masoretic text, which is many centuries after Christ. Now, the early church adopted the Septuagint as its Bible. You'll see sometimes when you read in the New Testament, there'll be a quote from the Old Testament, and you read it, and then you look up the passage in the Old Testament, and it's not the same. And you think, what's going on here? Are they paraphrasing? Was there another version floating around? Well, it may be some of both. The most likely scenario is that there were different versions of the text floating around. We find this with the Dead Sea Scrolls, that there were, for example, long and short versions of some books. Jeremiah, there was a long version and a short version. And the quotations in the New Testament are not from the sort of official Septuagint, but they're from another strand of a version of the Old Testament, Greek version of the Old Testament that was common in those days. So we had different versions of the Old Testament, not only different collections of books, but even different versions of those books floating around. So there was no, just as today with the Lutherans, there's no fixed canon, in Jesus' day, there was no fixed canon. Now, it's important to note that despite the fact that there was no fixed canon, Jesus could confidently quote the Scriptures and refer to them as authoritative. And this gets back to the whole issue of sort of the central core of books about which there's no dispute, and other books about which there may be. Like, for example, if you were a Lutheran, if you wanted to base a doctrine on something that's said in the Gospels, people would say, that's fine. If you wanted to base a doctrine on something in the book of Revelation or the book of Sirach, people would say, I don't know, maybe, because they're not certain if those books are really Scripture. Okay, now, I'm trying to make this simple and it's getting complex. You have the situation where the early church is using the Septuagint, and generally speaking, the Septuagint had the Catholic Old Testament with 46 books, and the Masoretic text, or what's sometimes referred to as the Palestinian canon, was the 39 books of the Old Testament. So some people say, and there's dispute about this, but some people would say that the 39 books in the Protestant Old Testament are the only ones in which there is a Hebrew original, that Maccabees and Sirach and those other books, we only have Greek. Now, some people say that. Some people dispute that. Some people say, no, we have Hebrew versions of the other books as well. Although, you have to stop and think, why does whether it was in Hebrew or Greek have anything to do with the question of whether it's Scripture? There are parts of the book of Daniel that are not written in Hebrew, and that doesn't keep them from being in Scripture. So, the basic dispute comes down to whether you're going to follow the early church in following, generally speaking, the Septuagint tradition of the Old Testament, or whether you're going to follow what later became the Jewish tradition typified in the Masoretic text of the 39 books. So that was the dispute. The early church, generally speaking, used the Septuagint. Now, here's what some people will say. Some Christians will say, look, the Jews were the ones who had the authority in the Old Testament to set the canon of Scripture. And so whatever canon they set is the canon for the Old Testament. And the church has the authority to set the canon for the New Testament. So whatever the church says about the New Testament applies. Well, that's an interesting idea. I think you'd have to ask, why do the Jews get to tell us what's in our Bible? Nothing against the Jews, of course. But why do the Jews get to tell the Christians what's in their Bible? That's one problem. The second problem is the Jews never did such a thing. There was no fixed canon of Scripture while the Jews, before the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the Jewish state and all those sort of things. There's this talk about this thing called the Council of Jamnia, where they supposedly set the canon of the Old Testament, but that probably never happened. There's no evidence that the Jews officially set a canon of Scripture any time before when, from a Christian perspective, the torch had passed and it was now the church's business. So we really have to look to the church to set the canon. And the early church, the majority witness in the early church and throughout the councils was that the books that the Catholics include in the Bible were part of Scripture. Now, I say it was the majority witness. There were people who disputed it. Cardinal Cajetan disputed it, and he was a Catholic in good standing. Jerome supposedly disputed it for a long time and then supposedly changed his mind toward the end of his life. I haven't really checked up all the details on that, and frankly, I don't care. The point is that the issue was not settled definitively until the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent was after Luther. So that's why we have this dispute between Catholics and Protestants. Basically, it's a dispute that goes way back into the early church, and it's not at all an issue of Catholics added the books and Protestants took the books away or anything like that. That's just a bunch of silliness that people say in, Jack Chick Tracts and whatever the Catholic equivalent of a Jack Chick Tract is. So when a Protestant goes to the Mass, he may hear a reading from the book of Sirach, and he's going to sit there and go, it's Catholics, why do they put this crazy stuff in the Bible? Well, they didn't put it in there. That book has been part of the faith of the Church since the beginning. From the very early days of the Church, people believed that the books of the Bible in the Old Testament, the Septuagint version of the Old Testament, were the Bible that they used. If you think about it, the early Church did not have a Bible. They didn't have the New Testament. It wasn't written yet. They didn't have a collection of the New Testament until into the 4th century. The Bible that they had was the Old Testament, and the Old Testament that they had was the Septuagint, and the Septuagint includes the books that are in the Catholic Bible. So that's why you see Catholic churches having these so-called additional books. Now, just in terms of terminology, Catholics call those additional books the deuterocanonical books. That means second canon. Protestants refer to them as the Apocrypha, which means outside of the writings. It means that they don't belong. So that's the terminology that's used. Now, in terms of whether those books are really canonical, there are a lot of people, and you can do some web searches on this, who've studied to see places in the New Testament that cite or refer or allude to deuterocanonical books. And there are a lot of examples of that sort of thing. So it's not anything like the Jack Chick rhetoric about the Bible. Okay, so that's the issue with the books of the Bible and why Catholics and Protestants differ on which books belong in the Bible. Okay, so the Protestant has now seen that the Catholics use this different collection of books, and if you know, if you've listened to what I said and you think it's reasonable, then you can at least understand where we're coming from, why we have those books. The next thing, of course, that happens in the Mass is after the reading of the, after the four readings, Old Testament, Psalm, Epistle, and Gospel, generally speaking, then the priest gets up and gives a homily. Homily is the Catholic word for sermon, basically. Unfortunately, it's this Catholic word for a short, bad sermon. Typically, Catholic homilies are not really very good. They're getting a lot better. This gets back to this whole question of the Catholic attitude towards Scripture. And, you know, years ago, it just wasn't an emphasis. And that was wrong, and the Church is doing a lot better at it. And the younger priests tend to be much better formed in their understanding of Scripture and in their understanding of how to preach. Now, they're still not up to the standards that I was used to in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, where we had, you know, solid pastors who would preach for 45 minutes, but they're doing a whole lot better. And the younger priests, older priests can preach too, of course, sometimes, but a lot of the younger priests have really gotten a lot better about preaching and teaching from the Scriptures. But generally speaking, it ain't great. If you're used to good, solid preaching in a Presbyterian church or a Baptist church, you're not going to get that in most Catholic churches. Now, I do know some priests who preach very, very well. You should listen to Father Charles Pope at St. Thomas More Parish in Washington, D.C. He preaches very well. And there are a lot of other Catholic priests who preach very well. But it's not the strong point of the Mass, let me tell you. So you go through the homily, and then after the homily, you have the profession of faith. We go through the Nicene Creed. And then after the Nicene Creed, we get to the dismissal of the catechumens, which is a little bit odd. You know, we're welcoming these people in. We want these people to become Catholics, and what do? We kick them out. Well, the reason for that is, remember I told you that we divide the Mass into two portions, the Liturgy of the Word and the Liturgy of the Eucharist, and non-Catholics don't partake in the Eucharist. And the people in the early church, what they did was they would dismiss the catechumens after the Liturgy of the Word so that they wouldn't participate in the mysteries in the Eucharist. And this led to people thinking that, you know, they were doing horrible things and eating people and cannibalism and all this crazy stuff people would accuse the Christians of doing. Now, of course, if you think about that, why would they have accused the Catholics of cannibalism if all they were doing was eating some bread and drinking some grape juice and thinking, gee, remember? So that points us to real presence, which we'll get to later on. But in the early church, they would dismiss the catechumens before the Eucharist, and we've revived that custom in the Mass these days. After the sermon, after the Liturgy of the Word, we dismiss the catechumens. They go off and have a class. You hope that it's not RCIA, but they have some sort of a class to help teach them about the Catholic faith to prepare them for entering into the church. And that'll be it for today. Next time we'll talk about what goes on between the end, wrapping things up there, and then getting into the Eucharist.